Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I want to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. I'm going to talk about the Billy Meier case this evening, particularly one of Billy's books called The Goblet of Truth. The first 14 chapters of The Goblet of Truth were literally pulled down from what are called the planetary storage banks. Our universe has a storage bank, but so does our planet. And these are accessible if you have the ability to go get information stored in them. So I'm going to set the time back to about, well, that's a good question, at the time of King Arthur. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what the Goblet of Truth has to say about the story of King Arthur. I haven't talked about this in a while. Let me start with Merlin. Merlin was a druid prince. He was a historian. He was someone that had actually come into contact with one of the early writings of Hanok. And I'm sure if you've heard the show before, you've heard me talk about the previous reincarnations of Edward Albert Meyer. The Meyer information explains that there have been 7 consecutive prophets that have incarnated on the earth now. And we start with a prophet that we call Enoch, but they called him Henoch back then. And Merlin had gotten a hold of one of the writings of Henoch. And they referred to this writing as... how did they refer to that writing? They referred to this writing... they called it the Cauldron of Life. At least Merlin did. Now, this had nothing to do with the Holy Grail. This was just one of the original writings of this prophet, Henoch, and it had the teaching of the Spirit, and it talked about the universal consciousness, and it talked about the creational natural laws, and it also talked about meditation. And Merlin became a teacher and a prophet, and he learned how to meditate after he studied the writings of Henoch. And Merlin was a druid. He was a member of the educated professional class among the Celtic peoples in Britain and in Ireland around the Iron Age. The Iron Age started about 1200 BC and then went, you know, on into many hundreds of years after the birth of Christ. Now, Merlin is considered a legendary figure in the King Arthur's legend. He was just a man that had learned meditation and how meditation can unlock the abilities that we all have. And where he meditated was a hill that had some trees and a stream, and it was a beautiful place where all of these Celtic druids meditated. And they called it, that was their Holy Grail, this meditation place. The Christians at the time, they got very spooked by Merlin because he developed abilities, prophetical abilities. He was considered a seer, and he gained this visionary ability because of his meditations. And there were something called the prophecies of Merlin were written down by a Welsh cleric named Geoffrey of Monmouth about 1135 AD. So, in one ancient manuscript, Merlin is supposed to have helped create Stonehenge with the help of a giant. However, the Meyer material really never supports that. Merlin actually came into contact with an extraterrestrial woman named Caradwina. Caradwina was a Plyaran, and she actually forged a sword, and I think she built this sword on the Isle of Avalon. And it was actually a technical weapon. It was like a laser-type weapon. And she ended up giving it to Merlin. Caradwina is Ta, or Ptah's great aunt. If you remember, Ptah is one of Billy's contacts. Caradwina gave Merlin this great sword, and Merlin treated it with tremendous respect. The legends called it the Excalibur. That was never its real name. It was called a strange name, Khalid Fluke, or something along those lines. It was about the best I can do as far as a pronunciation. Eventually, for one reason or another, Merlin gave this sword to King Arthur. And King Arthur was called the Boar of Cromwell. He was not a good-hearted king as depicted today. He was a very brutal man. He was a war king. His knights were bloodthirsty. And he was called the Boar of Cornwall. And he killed many, many people with this weapon. And human life meant little or nothing to him. He ruled in the 5th and the 6th centuries A.D. So this time period we're talking about is around 5 to 6 A.D. Eventually, when King Arthur died, he gave this sword back. Merlin took the sword after King Arthur died, and Merlin eventually gave the sword back to Caradwina, who took it off planet. So, this information is covered in more detail, I believe, in Contact Report 469. It's a very interesting bit of history that we have not heard yet. Now, the true Holy Grail existed as a holy place, as I said earlier. It's where the Druids meditated. One of the names of Merlin was the Laughing One. Sometimes this woman called Caradwina was also known as the Triple Goddess. Now, the Holy Grail is, in mainstream Arthurian legend, is considered a cup, and it was considered the Holy Chalice, and in connection with Joseph of Arimathea, it was supposed to have been used at the Last Supper, and eventually it was used to capture some of the blood when Christ was on the cross. Anyway, that's how the story goes. So that's Merlin, King Arthur, Caradwina, from the perspective of the Meyer material. I wanted to get slowly back to our topic this evening, which is the Dark Secret Order. This writing, The Goblet of Truth, has a lot of very, very interesting information, and it talks about a consciousness conditioned tyranny, which I think still exists on the earth. The consciousness conditioned tyranny came out of the military tyranny of the Roman Empire, and it moved into the Roman Catholic Church, and it manifested itself in the Spanish Inquisition in one way, where I think 18 million people were actually killed in the Inquisition, although our historians will not say that many. So this tyranny exists today, and it's a secret dark order that has come out of our ruling classes. And their goal is to capture all the money to completely gain entire mastery of the whole earth, the whole supremacy of the whole earth. This group is coming out of our ruling classes. They're spreading hatred, the poison of their hatred. And hatred, in some ways, is the opposite of the primary creational natural law that the Meyer material talks about, is love. And not love as affective love, but love as effective love. Effective love is a very stable, lasting love. Affective love is romantic and based on emotion. And often romantic love can actually become hostile. But the kind of love, for example, that's associated with nature even. Billy has written that the incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation, and that creation radiates love. So you could think of this dark order, this secret order of darkness with all their evil laws and ordinances, as functioning in direct opposition to these creational natural laws. These people are bent on hatred, and they've created a kind of economic prison for the people of the earth, and now people, a lot of people don't have homes now. They have no work. They go along with an idleness. They have an empty expression in their eyes. People don't know where they should go, what they should do. Nothing seems to bring them joy. And much of this is caused by this dark order that's spreading all over the earth. I have a clip here that is one of the... It'll show some horrifying sounds from some of these skull and bones rituals. Skull and Bones is the group in Yale that a lot of our presidents have actually come out of. So let's listen to a little bit from the Skull and Bones rituals.
Aid of the Skull and Bones initiation ceremony. It has never been broadcast before. Fifteen new members of the club are being introduced into the macabre rituals of Skull and Bones by the senior students who are about to graduate. The club has what some might see as a strange fascination with death, skulls and bones. There's the chants too, difficult to hear first of all, but including the devil equals death and death equals death. These rituals have been honed over centuries, giving the society a weird set of traditions, rules and secrets. For example, initiates are known as neophytes, outsiders are called barbarians, and the number 322 is sacred.
Critics of Skull and Bones insist that the society is not originally American, but rather an offshoot of some German right-wing order. This could well be true. Its founder, William Russell, did indeed live for some time in Germany before attending to his senior year at Yale. And it was actually on returning to the USA that he established the fraternity. Always according to its critics, the number 322, the order's identifying number, hides a coded message. The 32 represents the year of its foundation, 1832. And the additional 2 stands for the fact that it's the second chapter within an international order. Alexandra Robbins, a Yale graduate and author of a book on the subject, stated that the society owns a valuable collection of Nazi objects and memorabilia, and eats its dinners off Hitler's private silver service. A large part of their liturgy is written in German. Who was the fool? Who was the wise man? Beggar or king? Whether poor or rich, all's the same in death.
There was a break-in to the temple, and the students who broke in cataloged what they found, and they made a drawing, a design of the interior of the temple. And three of the rooms are numbered. One is 322, one is 323, and one is 324. 322 is also, I suspect, the chapter number. And also in correspondence between members, they conclude their correspondence, where you and I would conclude yours truly or yours sincerely. They conclude yours in 322. Why 322? There are several theories for this. One is that the order originated with Demosthenes, the Greek, in 322 BC. That's one theory. Another one is that it stems from the founding date in the United States, which was 1832. So really we have the last two numbers, 32, the second chapter of founded in 1832. The skull and crossbones are prominent in their ceremonies, initiation ceremonies.
This is a symbol of death. Now, why would they take a symbol of death?
Yes, from what I understand, when a new member is initiated, that would be in the senior year at Yale, he's placed within a coffin.
Oh my!
And now we only know this from the Yale Gate papers. At least I call it Yale Gate. And from the photographs we have of members inside the temple, many of these photographs are the 15 sitting around a table, and they have this skull and the crossbones sitting on the table in front of them. It is the symbol of death, and it has been called the Brotherhood of Death, and I think it probably more adequately should be called the Brotherhood of Death. So what I've had to do is look at the history, the biographies of the leading members of the order, and reconstruct their career and see if there's a common pattern in their careers. While doing that, I came across some interesting documents. Some members apparently are not too happy once they become involved with this after 10 or 20 years. One member in particular left a memorandum. He wrote it in 1932. He was buried away in his papers. I don't think anybody found it before I did. And it was a 6-page memorandum on the order, naming some of the members, and said it was the most sordid thing ever happened in the history of man. So, but to come back to my point, I have to reconstruct the objectives. What are the objectives? In the words of one member, might is right. If you have the power, you use it to achieve your objectives. What is the objective? As you look at the histories of individual members, it can only be one thing: to acquire power, to keep power, to use power for their own purposes.
In 1930, Prescott Sheldon Bush, father of President George H. and grandfather of President George W., a member of the Skull and Bones class of 1917, and president of the Union Banking Corporation, engaged in a number of profitable business deals with Fritz Thyssen, the German steel tycoon who supplied Hitler's war machine. The UBC was closed by President Truman during the Second World War under the Trading with the Enemy Act. In other words, for doing business with the Nazis. Apart from Prescott Bush, several other...
Perhaps we have more than one dark order. Maybe Skull and Bones is just one of these orders. I think there is another dark order associated with L. Ron Hubbard and the Scientologists. Remember, we are living in a consciousness-conditioned tyranny which sprang out of the Roman military tyranny. And Svath, Billy's first extraterrestrial teacher, warned him that we were entering into a time called the third millennium, and in the third millennium there would be maliciousness and confusion that would sweep over the earth, that our leaders would take away our rights of self-determination, they would become megalomaniacal, they would overemphasize their own importance. And this clip was talking about might-oriented thinking, and that's what Billy talks about a lot. That we here on the earth, we have kind of a might oriented thinking. That, in other words, if we have the power to do something, that we sometimes think we should just go ahead and do it. And that's exactly what we're doing to nature. Where if we can, you know, knock down a beautiful wooded area and put up a strip mall, we'll do it without thinking about what we're losing. See, the third millennium is a time when people will become indolent and obtuse. They'll be annoyingly insensitive. They will be slow to understand. They'll be indifferent. And they'll also become hopeless, as it was described in that passage. They will be hopeless. They will despair. They will be homeless at times. And they will literally seek to end their own lives at some point. We're seeing that, unfortunately, among our veterans who are killing. The one veteran kills himself almost every hour of every day. We're having 22 veteran suicides per day. See, this is the third millennium. This is the transition period from the time we're in now to the time when the teaching of the Spirit, the teaching of the truth, the creational natural laws will be understood again 800 years from now, when this information is finally paid attention to. Remember, the third millennium, it started when the United States dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You know, one of Billy's teachers, Semyase, said, "We're an insane society rushing headlong to our own destruction, and only a mass change of consciousness can save us from destroying our planet and destroying ourselves." So let's once again take a look at this dark order that's forming around us now.
Management. That's the cry.
So they got the profit, the power, and the management.
Mm-hmm.
Where do they want to steer history through the Bolshevik Revolution?
They wanted to set up, and they did, two opposing forces. Out of that came World War II. There were logical steps in the process. They used the same bank, Guaranteed Trust Company, as the conduit for the financing of Hitler, and also as a conduit for financing, and also the early days of the Russian Revolution. In fact, in Russia, Soviet Russia in 1923, a vice president of Guaranteed Trust Company was the foreign director of the Roskombank, which was the first Soviet overseas bank that was set up. They were that close in those days. You'll get a very close relationship between the early Hitler days and members of the order, which is in the third book.
By the end of the 1980s, the scandal concerning the Bank of Commerce and Credit International was making the headlines. The BCCI was accused of laundering drug money and financing terrorist operations. The scandal tarnished the reputation of the US government, since the bank operated freely in America and was a regular contributor to political campaigns. The administration of Bonesman George H. Bush blocked the investigation, which had in any case been entrusted to a Senate commission chaired by Bonesman John Kerry. The BCCI was absorbed by more respectable banks, and the subject was never revived. The government of the world's only superpower is packed with Bonesmen. George W. Bush named 11 Bonesman officials in his first government. Add to this various senators, congressmen, and chief justices, directors of the CIA, the Federal Reserve, and directors of banks such as J.P. Morgan Chase and Morgan Stanley Dean Witter. The American media is little different. Among others, Time and Newsweek magazines, in theory competitors, were both founded by Bonesmen. The oldest and most influential families also belong to this select club. Bush, Bundy, Harriman, Lord, Phelps, Rockefeller, Taft, Whitney. All of them have undergone the odd ritual of initiation. All have spilled their darkest secrets. All have been ritually humiliated in front of their peers. and all of them owe loyalty to the Order. It is estimated that there are some 800 bonesmen alive today, around half of them active and in key positions in the American economy and political establishment.
Of America happen to be their own best interests as well.
I have never seen anything in their literature which leads me to believe that they have our individual rights in their hearts. What I do see in the literature and in the documents is a ruthless drive to acquire power for themselves.
Evidence, a paper, peer-reviewed and published.
I know, and I've got some people looking at it.
Have you had a chance to look at the cover
letter?
I have
not personally, but they are looking at the paper you gave me.
Okay. If we give you, say, a week or two, can we get back to you after
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
Excellent. It's very important because it is evidence of treason.
I hear you.
You made Building 7 comments, Mr. Perry, before.
Yeah, thank you very much.
In a controlled fashion.
I do know that that wall, I remember, was in danger, and I think that they made a decision based on the danger that it had of destroying other things, that they did it in a controlled fashion.
You denied making those statements before, but in a bookstore you said that Building 7, which was not hit by an airplane, came down in 6 seconds, looked like it came down in a controlled fashion.
Building
7. I mean, you made some very, very, very interesting comments on Building 7. And then you denied making those comments when we interviewed you in New York.
Yes, yeah, did you clear that up because Building 7 is such an anomaly?
I don't have a record. I'd like to see specifically what I said. I don't have...
Did you see the building come down?
I don't have...
You said that this building came down in a controlled fashion, like they took it down.
No, I don't think I said... I'd like to see specifically what I said.
What is your feeling on how it came down?
Let me start fresh. Guys, I'm not...
Have you ever seen the photographs of the people in ISIS in those long caravans of identical white Toyota trucks? It's almost like someone gave ISIS a volume discount on Toyota trucks. Some of these dark companies or companies, some of these companies must have connections with some of these secret societies, maybe even terrorist groups. It's something to think about. John Kerry and George Bush were both members of the Skull and Bones organization. So this dark order is coming out of our governing class. It is kind of creating an economic prison for people. And people are now becoming homeless. We have the homeless veterans. And also people are in such despair and hopelessness, in many cases they're committing suicide, and unfortunately our veterans are doing that at an incredible rate today. And what we should be doing is learning the spiritual skills, like learning to control our thinking. Learning to clarify our thoughts. If you have positive information in your mind, clarify it, repeat it. You'll remove confusion from your stream of consciousness. Remember, your consciousness is like a garden, and you've got to weed it. You've got to keep it clean. You've got to take those weeds out that can grow, those negative thoughts that can permeate your consciousness, and then start to literally lead to insanity. Remember, we should be keeping a neutral, positive mindset. That's what the teaching of the Spirit is all about. Learning to keep a neutral mindset. Learning to observe and analyze your thinking. And one of the skills is meditation. Meditation is where you learn to clear your mind of all verbal thoughts, where you focus on images. I like to breathe deeply, take 3 deep breaths, and learn to release negative energy, and then focus on a blue sky, then focus on a green hillside, focus on the setting sun, focus on a red rose. I have a particular vision I like to keep in my mind of Mount Adams. And then just hold on to that quiet, beautiful image and just relax. Clear your mind. As soon as a thought comes in, push it out. Clear it out. This is relaxation. This is a skill we need to learn. Now, we're living in a time where people are disconnected from nature. And as I said earlier, the incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation. And creation is the superintelligence that created our universe. It's the universal consciousness. It's equalized. It's neutral. It radiates love. There's a beautiful passage I always quote from the Goblet of Truth. And this passage is entitled, What the Truth Knows to Say. And it goes on and says, rivers, stones, plants, trees, bushes, the air and water, everything that crawls and flies on the earth is a life form with a spirit form. And these spirit forms are on a journey through time that involve many, many lifetimes. And that death is just the passage to rebirth. Rebirth into the world of pure spirit. And many of these creatures are connected through these psychic swinging waves, and they communicate with one another. You know, there's a collective subconscious as well among humanity. And that's why someone will discover something on one side of the planet, and a few days later, someone else will discover another thing on the other side of the planet, because all of nature is connected. And I always urge people to find time to go into the forest. Especially, and even now, as early as it is, where I live here, you can start to hear the peepers and the frogs. There's a little swamp not too close to where I like to walk. And there's just incredible sounds. Incredible sounds come out of nature. And we need to reconnect to nature. And we need to understand that our lifestyle is destroying nature, destroying the very thing we need most of all to maintain our own psychic balance is our connection, the invisible connection with nature. And you'll be able to feel, it's called empfinden. It's a fine, sensitive feeling that if you become a good enough observer, so sit and listen to the birds sing, watch the trees, listen to the wind, reconnect with nature, and you can start to feel this empfinden. And the Meyer material puts it this way, it says that the life-giving energy of creation is trying to come into harmonious concord with all people, with the world, with the whole universe. Concord, it means to fit together, to join. And when you think of a harmony, think of a whole symphony, all these different instruments playing a chord, a beautiful chord that resolves. That's the kind of connection that this superintelligence tries to make with all living things. You see, love is the highest principle in creation, and everything follows that principle in absolute logic. So every tiny plant, every tiny animal fulfills its purpose in creation. But there's a dark order that's trying to interrupt this natural harmony of the natural world, and it's a secret dark order. And let's listen to one of the members of this dark order.
Let me take a look at what the transcript says, and we'll go from there. Okay?
Fair enough. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thanks. Got it?
Go ahead.
I don't have any idea what you're talking about.
Sir, please put that away.
Why don't you sign that for me?
Thank you very much.
Would you like to sign that?
Sir, you cannot videotape.
Would you like to take that information with you?
Sir. Okay.
Mr. Carey, can you clarify your statements on Building 7? There's not 11 heroes that support your statement that it did come down in a controlled fashion, sir.
Kevin McPadden, of course, his father,
Senator, about 1 year to this day in Texas, you said that Building Number 7, World Trade Center Number 7, looks like it went down. They did it in a controlled fashion, sir. Could you please articulate what you meant by the Salomon Brothers World Trade Center Number 7 was a controlled demolition and they had done it in a controlled fashion? You made that statement at the store called Book People in Austin, Texas on April 21st of 2007 when you were being questioned about the World Trade Center collapse of the Salomon Brothers building.
Thank you very much.
Senator Kerry, you cannot ignore these questions, Senator Kerry. Senator, yes, you did it. It's on YouTube, Senator.
They made a decision based on the danger that it had of destroying other things that they did it in a controlled fashion.
You are on file with testimony, Senator. You must clarify your remarks, Senator. Was it a controlled demolition, Senator Kerry? Skull and Bones. We know what it's about, Senator. We know everything about you.
Demolition team set off when you see the old demolitions of these old buildings.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely
encourage people to go and do the same thing and go to their police, tell them about today, give them the evidence. West Sussex Police have said they're investigating it, which they're obliged to do because the BBC had prior knowledge of a terrorist event, which under I think it's Section 38 of the Terrorism Act, they should have reported, which they didn't. And they've since given us this impossible flannel about World Trade Center 7 collapsing due to an office fire, which even in the NIST report says fell at freefall speed for 8 floors in 2.5 seconds. Now that is absolutely impossible without a controlled demolition being involved. Absolutely impossible. There's no arguments around it. Don't let anyone else tell you otherwise, because they're saying Isaac Newton is wrong.
Can you believe what you have been seeing on CNN today, ladies and gentlemen?
Can you believe it?
Supposedly, a CNN reporter found Osama bin Laden, took a television camera crew with him, went into Osama bin Laden's hideout, interviewed him and his top leadership, his top lieutenants and colonels and generals in their hideout. This is a CNN reporter with a camera crew. And he came out and told everybody, within 3 weeks, Osama bin Laden is going to attack the United States and Israel. Now, don't you think that's kind of strange, folks? You see, because the largest intelligence apparatus in the world, with the biggest budget in the history of the world, has been looking for Osama bin Laden for years and years and years, and can't find him. A reporter from CNN and his little camera crew got in to Osama bin Laden.
Very interesting clip there with Bill Cooper. The Henoch prophecies warn about war in our future, as well as the Goblet of Truth talks about this coming third global conflagration, which may be a third world war. It could be the collapse of nature. The Henoch prophecies say the greatest disaster in human history could occur in the North American continent when chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons are released by automated systems that run outside of human control. There are some potential things that could happen in our near future that are a little overwhelming. Time is running out for us. We've got to get sane people in control of our governments again and stop this secret order from gathering any more power.
And conducted an interview. If you don't believe me, tune in to CNN. They're probably running it right now as I'm speaking. And if you believe it, you are one of the stupidest jerks that ever lived on the face of this earth. And whatever is going to happen that they're going to blame on Osama bin Laden, don't you even believe it. When in hell are all you people going to wake up?
So if 9/11 was really an inside job, then who are the people inside that did it? Well, we can start by looking at some of the people inside the buildings that were targeted and destroyed on 9/11. In the impact zone of the North Tower was a company called Marsh & McLennan, which at the time was the world's largest insurance brokerage company. One of Marsh's executives was a guy named L. Paul Bremer, who was also the chairman of the Congressional National Commission on Terrorism from 1999 to 2000, and the U.S. Ambassador at Large for Counterterrorism from 1986 to 1989. Instead of going to work on the day of 9/11 and dying inside the towers with hundreds of his employees, Bremer decided to go on MSNBC and tell the world that Osama bin Laden was behind the attacks and possibly Iraq and Iran, and then he demanded
the most severe military response we can come up with.
L. Paul Bremer was called away from Marsh in 2003 to become the Iraq occupation governor, a role he has been widely criticized for. So Bremer not only worked inside the buildings, but had offices directly in the impact zone of the South Tower where Flight 175 would hit. He missed work on 9/11 to give us the official story on national television and went on to be the Iraq occupation governor. You really can't get more connected to 9/11 than that. Oh wait, you can, sorry. I forgot to mention that Bremer was also the former manager for Kissinger Associates. He was a member of the board for AkzoNobel, the parent of International Paint Company, which produced a fireproofing application for skyscrapers called Interchar. Bremer was also on the international advisory board for the Japanese mining and machinery company Komatsu, which at the time had been involved in a joint venture agreement with Dresser Industries, the oil services intelligence front where Prescott Bush Sr. and George H.W. Bush got their start with Neil Mallon. Anyway, the Komatsu Dresser Mining Division operated from 1988 to 1990. And in July 1996, it patented a nanothermite demolition device that could, quote, demolish a concrete structure at high efficiency while preventing a secondary problem due to noise, flying chips and dust, and the like. As many of you know, residues of thermite, a highly energetic chemical mixture, have been confirmed in samples of World Trade Center dust, and the use of thermite at the World Trade Center was also revealed by environmental data. See the description for more links and sources. But wait a minute. It would have taken tons of this stuff. How could they get it inside the buildings and put it into place without anyone finding out? This would have taken hundreds of people. Someone would have talked by now. It just doesn't make any sense. Well, who ran security for these buildings? Marvin Bush's company, Securecom Stratasec, did, up until 1998, when that role was handed off to Kroll Associates. Yet Stratasec still retained security contracts that didn't expire until the day of 9/11. Both these companies have a suspicious cast of characters working for them. Bush's cousin, Wirt Dexter Walker III, was the CEO of Stratasec with a long history as a manager for CIA front companies, such as Glor Forgan. The corporate operating officer of Stratasec was a guy named Barry McDaniel, who came from BDM International, where he was a vice president of material distribution and management systems. He also had a history of involvement with black projects. Securicom Stratasec also ran security at Dulles International Airport, where Flight 77 into the Pentagon was hijacked out of, and also had contracts with United Airlines. They also ran security at Los Alamos National Laboratories during the time period that nanothermite was first being developed there. Then there's Kroll Associates, also known as the CIA of Wall Street. Kroll's managing director was a guy named Jerome Hauer, who, like L. Paul Bremer, survived the 9/11 attacks by going on national television to give us the first accounts of the official story. Before anyone knew it was happening, these guys apparently had it all figured out. In addition to being managing director for Kroll, Jerome Hauer was the national security advisor with the National Institute of Health, which managed the government response to the anthrax attacks shortly after 9/11. On the day of 9/11, Hauer advised the White House to start taking Cipro, an antibiotic effective against anthrax, and then strangely a week later, two senators and several people in the media who had been calling for an investigation into the 9/11 attacks were mailed anthrax and told to shut up, apparently by members of Al-Qaeda, who later turned out to be a bioweapons researcher at U.S. AMRID in Fort Detrick, Maryland, named Stephen Hatfill, who had worked with Jerome Hauer for a company called SAIC.
The next clip I have is Jim Fetzer talking about how nations are destroyed economically by these dark orders, the global elite. He's discussing a book by John Perkins, I believe, that's entitled Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And there are several other Veterans Today speakers there as well. Many of these corporations are linked to these dark orders, secret societies, to these might-oriented thinkers who are destroying the very planet that we live on, who are spreading this poison, their hatred, all over the earth.
Confessions of an Economic Hitman, in which he explained how the West was using the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank to entrap these countries that are less well-developed by giving them exorbitant loans for projects, often ones they don't even need, and then when they default on their payments, demanding the natural resources from those countries as the compensation, and if they then hesitate, sending in military force. I mean, it's been a tried and true method used again and again and again. Anyone out there in our audience who's never read John Perkins' book must do that, because it lays out the master plan that the West has been using for the last 50 years to seize the assets of other nations without any respect or regard whatsoever for their own well-being, just using them as a means, exploiting them. It's a form of a colonial expansion operation, but it's just a neo-colonialism policy, because it's hidden subterfuge by the cloak of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
Well, that's right, and what it is really high-tech blackmail by usury is what it is, because they set up these complex financial arrangements where the interest on the loan accrues so fast there's no way they can repay it, and of course once they've got the country trapped, then they threaten to seize things, and pretty soon what they've done is they go to the people involved and say, look, there's another way. We don't have to just take everything you have. If you cooperate with us, we'll take certain key things we want, these rare earth minerals or this oil or these various things, we'll split the profits with you. So you're not going to be completely ripped off. We'll give you a bank account in Switzerland, a numbered account in the Cayman Islands, and we'll give you set-aside allocation. So all you have to do is play balls. It doesn't have to be really bad. We're not going to take everything. All we want is a fair share for backing you financially. So the top leaders sell out, Jim, and then after a period of time, if they die or leave office, then what the banksters are in the driver's seat. They're in complete control of the country. Then they cede all the political offices with their people that they own. They fund the elections. Pretty soon everybody in their legislature works for the banksters.
Well, it's very clear that...
Isn't that the way it is here now?
1% right.
400
yeah.
men on 97% of the economy, and they're in control of what? 99% of the Congress and Senate, and 44 percent of them are blackmailed with kids or baby screwers up in the Congress and Senate. Isn't that about right, Doc?
Yeah. How about 12 men, though? The rest of them are stooges. The rest of them are stooges.
Yeah, and 400 men make more money per year than half the population of 330 million Americans. I would say that, you know, if we had 100 million Americans locked and loaded and we went out there and just took care of the problem, we could clean house in one day.
Well, it may come to that.
To having a normal business again.
Jim, Professor Fetzer, I wanted to ask you, you know, I read Perkins' book when it first came out, and it was over my head. I had to read it a second time. I thought, this just can't be true. He was talking about how a lot of the leaders in, you know, the leaders of the developing nations envy the developed nations. They want new roads, they want libraries, they want schools. And so he would go in with a prearranged contract backed by the World Bank, and he'd set this contract down and say, you know, you get all these things, all you have to do is sign this. And then if they were resistant at all, he'd pull a bullet out of his pocket and set it down and say, here's your deal. It's a bullet or this. Because he said, look, I'm your friend. If you go along with this, we can get you everything you need. It can be a win-win situation. But if you don't, they're going to send the jackals in. I can't control these people. There's really bad people that want to get you. And if you work with me, I can protect you. If you work, sign this contract, we can have a relationship. We can rebuild your whole country and all this stuff. But if you don't, I have nothing to say about it. They will send the jackals in. And that's what they did with Saddam Hussein. When he cooperated, he got the gold. When he stopped cooperating and wanted to go with his own independent bank, that's when they sent the jackals in. Well, he had five doubles. And they knocked off a couple of his doubles, but they didn't get him. So that's why we went to war. When that fails, when the jackals can't get somebody, that's when they go to war. But, you know, I had to read that book twice for it to really sink in, Jim. It's really shocking stuff, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. It is, Preston. And just as an aside, we actually took out Saddam 3 weeks into the invasion of Iraq. A B-1 bomber pilot by the name of Chris Wachter took him out with two JDAM bombs. He was given the coordinates to a restaurant on the outskirts of Baghdad, that this was the big one. He didn't know his target, but he took out Saddam, his two sons, and 50 or 60 members of the general staff. Even Dick Cheney reported that they dragged his lifeless body out of the rubble. When he returned to base, he was lionized, put on CNN. He was given the Distinguished Flying Cross. This is why, however, the mission accomplished celebration on the USS Lincoln had to be altered. Bush wanted to go and announce that they got Saddam Hussein, but someone observed, and we believe it was Donald Rumsfeld, that the three presidents had signed executive orders precluding the assassination of the leader of a foreign nation, Carter, Ford, and Reagan. So that if he'd actually announced it, he would have been in violation of the law. So they had to compromise. That's why the whole thing was such a mess. He couldn't actually report what he wanted to report. Instead, after Chris Wachter had been feted at the Crystal Cathedral in Anaheim in Orange County, the most conservative county in the United States, therefore in the world, where the service was broadcast by television, he was directed to fly back to Langley, where they told him that while they admired his flying skills, that officially Saddam had got away. They put one of his doubles in a spider hole, claimed to have discovered him there, put him on trial. Even his own wife, Saddam's wife, went to visit him after arrangements were finally made by the Red Cross and came out screaming, "This is not my husband! This is not my husband! What have you done with my husband?" They went ahead and put him on trial. Joe Vales from Australia had noticed that the bite was wrong, the teeth were wrong, and I verified he was right about both. This was not Saddam, one of his doubles, and apparently they gave him an arrangement where if he played along with the trial, then they'd put a stool underneath the gallows so that when he dropped, he wouldn't actually be hung. But I think when the time came, they forgot about the stool. They couldn't afford to have the guy around where he might talk about it.
Well, that's right.
Interesting discussion there on Veterans Today. I thought was rather interesting. Anyway, the Meyer material does talk about this dark order, and we'll certainly do more shows on this. I appreciate everyone coming. I hope you've enjoyed these particular shows. Make sure to visit us at exopoliticsohio.us, Google Ohio Exopolitics, and come and see the website. We keep the archives out there. If you want to catch up on old archives, Google Ohio Exopolitics, go to exopoliticsohio.us and go to the archives page. You can also listen to Ohio Exopolitics on freedomslips.com and Studio B, 8 p.m. Eastern. And on Saturday, March 28th, we will have Colonel Donald Ware on discussing UFOs, extraterrestrials, the Urantia book, and I believe the Second Advent. I hope you've enjoyed the show. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and we'll be back. Have a good evening. Mm-hmm.